This episode of On Comedy Writing is brought to you by Saucy. Listeners, what do you know about me? Well, you know I love comedy. You know I love... God, what have I revealed on this podcast? Huh. Well, you don't know much about me. But one thing you should know is that I'm an out-of-control drunk. I can't get enough of the nectar known as alcohol. Well, good news for me, Saucy is beer, wine, and spirits ordered online and delivered directly to your door. That's right, directly to your door. You no longer have to leave your house to get your freaking fix. I can be doing the stink and still be getting a drink, the stink being taking a shit. Alcohol delivery in 30 minutes. Shop over 10,000 products at great prices. You can order craft beer, wine, and spirits online or download the mobile app for iOS or Android. Stay in and order a drink. There's no delivery fees and no minimums, not like those pesky comedy clubs. Although, they have a 2-drink minimum. I think I'm going to get 4, 5, 6, 20 drinks when I order this. Order the drinks you want, and in 30 to 60 minutes, have a drink at your door, or schedule alcohol delivery when it's best for you. It's always good for me. Plus, they have snacks, mixers, and more, all available for delivery in less than an hour. To get alcohol delivered to your door and to save 10% on your order, go to boardwalkaudio.com/saucy. That's boardwalkaudio.com/saucy, S-A-U-C-E-Y.
This is a Boardwalk Audio podcast.
On comedy writing, on comedy writing.
Thanks for downloading this episode of On Comedy Writing, the podcast about the business and craft of writing comedy. I'm your host, Alan Johnson. We've got a great episode, but first, the best way to support the show is by going to boardwalkaudio.com/oncomedywriting. Click the Support Our Artist button and shop on Amazon like you normally would, and we get a little kickback. Real quick, before we get into the episode, go check out the new Boardwalk Audio website. It's very cool, and I'm very happy to be part of this network, especially on the East Coast. Only East Coast Boardwalk Audio podcast, I believe. Isn't that something? Our guest this week is Sam West. He was a big Onion Video guy, and he's responsible for some of their classic web series like Porking Across America, Lake Dredge Appraisal, and perhaps my favorite web series of all time, I think it is, Sex House, which is so funny. He's also done a couple infomercials for Adult Swim, and he's worked a lot in animation, including the upcoming Colbert-produced Our Cartoon President, which is coming up on Showtime in a few weeks. If you like this episode, check out our episodes with Craig Rowan, Matt Kleinman, Chris Kula, and Jeff Loveness, who all worked at The Onion. So here is Sam West. Sam, thanks for coming to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Alan.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, District of Columbia.
What was it like growing up there?
It was good. It was like, you know, it got better as I grew up. It was kind of a nasty place in the late 80s, early 90s, but I avoided most of that by being born relatively well off not in the murder parts of town.
I didn't know it was like that.
Yeah. It was kind of grimy there, but I know
there was like a punk scene.
There was.
But that was like probably before then, right?
Yeah, there was like residual stuff there. The high school that I went to was kind of like a locus of that punk scene from back in the day. Mm-hmm. So that kind of affected a lot of us as teenagers, kind of knowing that that was there.
Interesting.
And kind of believing that it was over, even though we could have probably done it ourselves if we really wanted to. We're just like, no, that happened in the 80s, so that can't be done again.
Were you interested in like comedy stuff growing up?
Yeah, totally. That was kind of like my outlet when I was young, because I, you know, like a lot of like awkward teenagers didn't really know what was going on, but like I knew what made me laugh, and so I kind of like would get together with my friends and like make movies and stuff like that, and that kind of like took me through high school.
What kind of stuff were you watching when you were growing up?
Probably the same stuff that everyone's been telling you, like The Simpsons, SNL, Monty Python, Mr. Show, stuff like that. Yeah. All the classics. Everything that was good and nothing embarrassing. Certainly no Kevin Smith movies.
Yeah, Kevin, that's like an embarrassing thing now, I guess.
I don't know. It's weird. I have to be honest. I really liked Clerks a lot when I was like 13. It blew my mind. I didn't know. That was like one of those things that kind of awakens you and like lets you know that that's something that you can do and that you can kind of like do your own thing. Even though now people look back on it and it's like, oh, it's vulgar, it's crude. But like if you're 13, like, you know, that's the best shit ever.
And at the time, too, people like loved it, I feel like.
And it was kind of an early like... it kind of presaged all the not specifically Star Wars worship, but like a lot of just like the cultural reference comedy that has become like, I mean, there were always cultural references in comedy, but like specifically like pop culture heavy, like nerd comedy stuff. Like I feel like kind of got into the mix with a lot, with some Clerks action.
Yeah, and so that's kind of the backlash.
Yeah, maybe. Well, he kind of went so far into it now. And now he has his own mythology and like his own sort of universe, and you know,
yeah.
Like part of that was appealing too, the idea of having your own little like cinematic world that kind of continues from movie to movie. I thought that was interesting. Although he definitely, I'm sure he didn't pioneer that, but like in the context of a comedy, that felt new to me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's still no one really does it except for like the big action tentpoles, like the Marvel. Yeah. And well, I mean, like, Universal Monsters.
For sure. Well, it's all about the universes now. But like, but I feel like it's in comedy now, isn't it? I don't know. I can't think of an example off the top of my head.
Well, I guess there's like the Judd Apatow movies aren't really connected, I feel like.
Yeah. They're just kind of in Judd Apatow world. But the characters don't like hang out from movie to movie.
Right. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
That would be cool if like the guys are knocked up hanging out with the the guys in Superbad, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
So you were making movies with friends?
Yeah. We would just kind of like shoot sketches. That was all we really felt like we could do. I mean, you know, we had like little VHSC cameras and like mini DV tapes and stuff like that. The most ambitious thing we ever tried to do was like an action movie when we were in like ninth grade, and it was just, it's so bad that it became hilarious. And I kind of like, I still have a lot of these tapes, and like every once in a while I'm like cleaning my stuff and I'll like find one, and like this like ninth grade action movie is by far the funniest thing that we ever made in that era.
You tried to make it very earnest.
Yeah, we were trying to be very serious, but we're all sort of like crack voiced, you know, like 14-year-olds trying to do like a, you know, like post-Soviet thriller or something like that, with like drug running and stuff.
I'm a big fan of the post-Soviet action genre.
Yeah, man.
I wish the Red Dawn, I wish they did it at the remake. I wish it was post-Soviet again.
But yeah, they did like a... Well, you got to update it for the current paranoias. Right?
Yeah, I suppose so. But you made like sketch type stuff too?
Yeah, I was just kind of like a loser in like, you know, junior high school, and like I had like two friends, and we would like every weekend we would just like hang out, you know, through the night, shooting dumb, like, sketches that we would kind of, like, steal, you know, lines from SNL sketches and stuff that. Yeah.
Do you remember any of those, what the sketches were?
Not really. There's nothing worth mentioning. I mean, there was nothing good. It was, like, you know, stuff eighth graders were doing. Eighth, ninth graders, man. Like, it was very primitive, but it instilled that sort of, the idea that, like, this is really fun. And doing this is like its own reward, sort of. That was like a major thing. And that kind of, it like compounded to a point where like by the time I was like a junior, senior in high school, I was like, you know, pretty proficient at editing, was writing actual scripts and like, you know, doing like larger scale productions that would get to be like 20, 30 minutes long. And, you know, that became my fixation. By the time, like, my senior year of high school, some friends and I put together, like, a film festival in D.C. with, like, some other kids from other high schools, and that was, like, a big thing for us.
Oh, wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Were you more interested in, like, film or comedy specifically?
Comedy felt like the only thing that we could, like, do. I was interested in film. I mean, you know, it was that... It was that time when if you were in like seventh grade or like maybe even like sixth grade, like somebody you knew would be like, yo man, you got to watch Pulp Fiction. Like, have you ever seen this? Like we were just at that age when we were getting like put onto like weird, interesting sort of like cult movies and like, you know, just generally weird stuff that you weren't used to as like an elementary school student. And like that made me want to make movies. But, the only thing that felt like within our production range was like goofy sketches.
Yeah. I was wondering, I was thinking about this recently because like I majored like in film.
Yeah.
And I was thinking like, man, if I was offered like to direct a big action movie, I wouldn't know where to start.
Yeah.
I'm always I'm kind of amazed that people
like make like the guy who did like Jurassic World. Mm-hmm. Like he made that like Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he made Jurassic World. That's crazy.
That is, that's wild. I feel like you probably get support when from the massive studio in some ways. I mean, like my understanding of it now is that like you kind of don't even get to make that many calls as a director on a movie like that. But I don't know. I mean, like that still seems like a gigantic, like Herculean task.
Yeah, it's insane. So when you were going to college, did you know what you wanted to like major in and do?
Well, originally I wanted to go to film school, but then I convinced myself that that was impractical. And so I was like, I'll get an education, and then if I still want to do film, I'll go to grad school. And so I studied history in college, but like I came to New York for college, and the idea was like, I want to be near like a comedy scene that I know exists and that I like want to be a part of. And like, it seemed like everything that I liked the most, like, you know, like the Conan O'Brien show and like the Onion, like that was all happening in New York. And I was like, okay, well that's where I should probably go. And maybe I can like sniff it out once I'm there. And I was lucky enough to kind of like make that work, with the Onion eventually.
Yeah, that's cool. What exactly did you, like, know about the New York comedy scene? You mentioned, like, Conan and the Onion, but do you know anything else, like, about it? Like,
Well, I knew about UCB.
Yeah.
Like, in high school, I remember going to the UCB website and just being like, whoa, 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 you can actually, like, go to a show for $5. That's pretty cool. That felt to me more like the music scene stuff that I was used to. It continues to be extremely bewildering to me that, like, most shows in New York cannot be seen for under, like, $50. And I get why that is. I know about, like, unions. I know about costs. And, like, I know about tourists. But, like, it is kind of, you know, now, obviously, being here forever and knowing about, like, every like, bar that has a comedy show in the basement, that's great, too. But, like, at the time, I was like, I don't know. The only club in D.C. that, like, did comedy was the Improv. And that was cool, but it's, like, your classic, like, two-drink minimum comedy club, and it didn't really feel that alive. I'm sure I found out about it because of the UCB sketch show on Comedy Central, but like eventually it was Googling stuff and like found my way to like the calendar and I was like, oh wait, I recognize some of these names. I can go see these people perform for like $5. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny now thinking of UCB like that. I mean, cause things have changed so much, obviously. Sure. But yeah. So in college, were you doing any like, any comedy stuff?
Yeah, I did like when I got to college, I was intending to write for like the Campus Humor magazine, and then when I got there, I discovered that it had shut down between the time that I'd visited and the time that I had like matriculated, which was a bummer. But that kind of like created this opening where like I could kind of, if I did this administrative maneuver, I could kind of take over the publication and then just like rebuild it from the ground up.
Wow.
And so that's what I did. And so I like edited this magazine for a couple of years and then kind of passed it off to some friends. And like, I think they're still doing it now.
And you did that like as a freshman, you like just started the club back up?
Yeah. It took like a year to like get it all together. Yeah. But like we put out the first issue, I think the fall of my sophomore year, fall semester. And then we would do like, I think 2 issues a semester. Maybe the first semester, just one. I don't really remember, but yeah, it was cool. It was a way to, at that point, it was like I wasn't making any like videos anymore. Cause it was like, I had this kind of crew that would all get together in high school and do it. We were all scattered across the country. Mm. And I was also just kind of like, it takes a long time. Like it's so much more immediate to write stuff. Like I really want to write short form stuff. At a certain point, you know, in high school, someone had showed me like a Harvard Lampoon and I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. And also, of course, at that point, I'd like read like, oh, that's how people like start doing comedy. They like work for the Harvard Lampoon or whatever. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just work for whatever Harvard Lampoon is at my school. And like, they didn't have one, so I just made one. But yeah, so that's kind of like cheating though, because I didn't actually have to like impress anyone. I was just like, fuck this, I'll like do my own version.
That's definitely harder, I think, what you do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but at least you can pick all your own jokes. You don't really have to be edited, which is cool. I like got to sort of like shape it in my own voice, which was nice.
And so what was like, were you guys doing like Onion style stuff or was it more Lampoon?
It was very Lampoonish. Okay. It was what is now, I have this my opinion is that like Twitter is now like the national like college comedy publication, even though like the jokes, I actually think like the jokes on Twitter are probably the best jokes in existence. Mm-hmm. Not that all Twitter jokes are good, but like I'm not really on Twitter either, so it's kind of weird. But like I think like that style of stuff, what would have been on Twitter when I was a freshman in college and Twitter didn't exist, was like the type of stuff that we were trying to put into this comedy magazine, like weird Twitter, basically in print, basically. Wow. Harvard Lampoon weird shit, kind of like absurdist humor.
That's interesting because I wouldn't. I haven't read that much Harvard Lampoon, but I wouldn't necessarily describe it.
It's
similar.
Not that absurdist. That's true.
Yeah,
but there is a lot of what I really liked about the Harvard Lampoon is how they mixed formats freely.
Right. Yeah.
And I also like had seen like Found magazine when I was in high school, and so I was like, oh, well, maybe it would be cool to have a humor magazine that's kind of like Found, where you like turn the page and it looks like a document that someone like pulled off of like the street and has like a footprint like on it, and like you don't really know where it came from, or it's like a poster, or it's like a pamphlet or a manual, or like some sign like mixed with a cartoon, mixed with like a list of jokes. Like basically at that point I was like, I just want to do absurd shit and laugh and have it not take much time, and like, and just kind of have a release, because it was like I was working really hard, like doing fucking college shit, like writing essays and whatnot, researching history.
That's interesting that you say Twitter is the best jokes right now.
I do think that. I mean, and I say that, like, take that with a grain of salt. As I mentioned before we started recording, I'm very tired because I took a red-eye flight yesterday, and so maybe I'm just, like, down on like, TV jokes. But I do like the freedom that exists on Twitter. And I'm interested in how, you know, people that were like, and this is just, maybe it's more interesting to me because I never did Twitter really, but like the way that people who began as Twitter comedians are translating into writing TV, I'm like waiting for that TV show that really feels like what I really like about like jokes on Twitter, because I don't quite think it's happened yet. And I think maybe something about TV is necessarily, you know, it smooths it out in a way that, like, I don't know, can't quite put my finger on it.
No, that's interesting, because, like, even, like, probably, like, the most famous, like, Twitter comedian, like, Rob Delaney,
mm-hmm.
his show feels nothing like Twitter.
Sure.
It's, like, it's very good, but in a different way.
Yeah, I just think there's no way to really translate that. It's so short form, and, like, it has to have all its context right there. Like, you can't, I mean, there's types of jokes that you can never do on Twitter that you could do on TV. But, like, you know, I think it cuts both ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'd love for Drill.
Yeah.
That guy. I think that guy could maybe do something interesting. Like,
yeah.
He's like a copywriter or something. Like,
I know. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I was going to bring that up. Like, it's so weird to go and look at his, like, graphical work. Because he, like, I think he does, like, he's like a draftsman. He, like, makes posters and stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, he himself cannot translate his style of writing into into a visual representation, I don't think. Like, when you look at his graphics, you're like, that wasn't made by him. That's, like, someone else using his, like, copy,
mm-hmm.
but with a weird image.
Yeah,
like, it's something about the way that the writing is done that, like, is so unique that, like, it really can't be translated.
I think it's also interesting about Drill is that he's a guy who isn't a comedian,
mm-hmm.
and also doesn't really want to be known.
Right.
And that's a cool thing about Twitter, that you can just do that. You can be, like, anonymous.
Yes.
And also not a comedian, just a normal guy. And he's probably the funniest account on the website, I'd say.
Yeah. I think that's really cool. I like anonymity. I think like mystery is a undervalued thing.
Yeah.
In like art these days. I'm not like super into the whole, like, you know, be friends with your celebrities era.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I think the more I learn about, like, for example, like David Simon, the creator of The Wire.
Oh, well, yeah.
He had a blog, too, before he started tweeting all the time, that I would read, like, religiously, because I'd be like, oh, man, like, David Simon has deigned to write something down. He's, like, opening his mouth to speak. Like, I must listen. But now I kind of see him on Twitter all the time just, like, interacting with trolls, and I'm just like, I don't want to know that you're doing that. Like,
yeah.
I still really respect him as, like, a artist, but I'm just like, oh, man, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Just like just put the art out and let that stand for itself.
Yeah. So someone who actually does a good job of that is like Bo Burnham, which is funny because he started like as a YouTube guy, but I feel like now I only really ever hear about him, or he's like he only like says like, hey, I have a movie coming out, like a movie like at Sundance now coming out like this week, and he posts a trailer or something.
Whoa.
And then like he just dropped like a stand-up special. He wrote a book and like he didn't like. There's, like, not much else. He's not, like, tweeting all the time and doing stuff.
He no longer promotes it constantly?
Yeah. He'll just, like, he'll like say, hey, it's coming out tomorrow and stuff like that, which is interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. So how'd you get involved with The Onion?
I was an intern. I started. Oh. So, like, I was – when I was in – my understanding of The Onion was, like, you can't apply to work there. Like, the legend of it was that, like, you – even like professional comedy writers like can't get read by The Onion. Like there, it's just like it's like a small group that is like pals, and they don't want any like outsiders involved. That's like it turns out that's like a bit of a myth, but also like it kind of was just like, well, I will never try. I won't like try to like find an Onion internship. But then they posted one that was like, we need video people. And I was like, oh, well, that's my thing, and it's something they don't do already, so maybe I can get involved that way. And so, like, I applied and got the internship for what would be the Onion News Network, but then they, like, rerouted me to work on the Onion movie as an intern, which was, like, they were trying to rewrite it, and the rewrite that they were working on, I don't believe, was ever, like, filmed, but, like, they had shot it, and they were disappointed with it, and they're trying to, like, fix it, basically. And so I wound up working under the editor... at the time, Scott Dickers, and the head writer at the time, Todd Hansen, and I was just basically, you know, their intern for this project. So I'd go in and like help them collate scripts and like sketches that they were soliciting from their friends. And at the end of that, you know, they were like, oh, we also have this like Onion News Network thing we're trying to start. It wasn't called that at the time. It was just called like Onion Web Video. Do you want to like submit a list of headlines? And I was like, yes. And so I started doing that, and they liked it, and eventually they started paying me for freelance, and I did that for a couple of years, and then when I graduated college, I was lucky enough to be offered the full-time job as a staff writer, which was great, which was, like, the best. That was, like, the happiest I'd ever been.
What was it like working on the Onion movie?
It was weird because, like, they'd already been so embittered by the process that they were... just sort of like it felt like I think it was kind of like a chore to them. I think they didn't really believe that it was happening. Like they were like, we're gonna try this, but my memory of it is that they were not particularly optimistic about it. They were just sort of like the thing I remember Todd Hansen telling me is that like they kept asking them to meet them halfway, the studio that is, I guess, which was, I don't know, forget what the studio was, but like he was like, yeah, they keep asking us to meet them halfway, and then, like, we'll meet them halfway, and then they'll ask us to meet them halfway again, and before we know it, like, we're on the 95-yard line, and they're, like, moving the goalposts further, and I was like, oh, that's a bummer. But, yeah, I just remember it was a lot of, like, stapling scripts and, like, meeting those dudes in Park Slope at their, like, weird studio space and just kind of, like, helping them out with, like, errands and stuff. But it, like, you know, it allowed me to get to know them a little bit, so... they, you know, they gave me that shot, and so that's the best possible outcome.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what that the script that they were working on was going to be?
It was going to be a sketch movie. I mean, like, it kind of was already.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I remember that is because I remember reading, like, a Scott Aukerman script that they had solicited, which I thought was hilarious. And I remembered knowing that name from Mr. Show as a writer, and so I was excited to, like, read a sketch as written by... a writer that like had written stuff that like I loved.
Yeah.
Because you just don't, I didn't know at the time like what a sketch really looked like on paper, like professionally. I knew what it looked like when like I wrote it for fun, but I didn't know really what like a script formatted sketch looked like at that age, which is cool. But like, yeah, I think it was basically like they kind of sent out a like call to their friends. It wasn't all fake news, which is weird. I think it was kind of like, I mean, I think it's similar to what actually came out, which is, I mean, have you ever seen The Onion movie? It's on DVD.
I think I saw it when it came out, like forever.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like, it's okay. There's parts of it that like kind of resemble The Onion News Network, but it was just not really directed with the level of dryness that that we eventually would settle on for the Onion News Network, which I think was like the correct sort of like pure, like exact parody of what you expected to look and sound right. like. The way that the Onion newspaper was like the exact pitch perfect parody of a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
In terms of like its tone and its presentation. But yeah, it's like, I think it was just kind of like newsroom tossed to sketch basically, or like a sketch would happen and then like the protagonist would walk by a like storefront with TVs in it. And then he'd like okay. zoom in on a TV that was playing the Onion like news channel.
The lazy Mr. Show edit.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think so. I can't say for yeah. sure. I don't really know.
Uh-huh.
It's so hazy. And I just know that like it never happened. And so whatever I did remember about it, I was like, oh, well that was like an abortive attempt at something. Mm-hmm. So maybe it took five different forms before they even like killed it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think they released it after deciding that they weren't going to proceed with any of the reshoots or whatever.
So the Onion News Network just started like when you got there?
Onion News Network started in like 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I was interning in the summer of 2006. I was about to start my junior year at college. And they were kind of just putting together a bare-bones staff. They were, like, trying a lot of stuff in that first, like, 6 or 7 months. We didn't actually put out any videos until, like, April of 2007, I think. But in the interim, they were, like, rounding up a bunch of, like, UCB performers that they liked. And like trying to like do like improvised Sunday morning talk show bits. And then we started adding more script elements to those and trying to like give them more of an outline. And at the same time, we were like starting this like newsroom show and like trying to figure out what the form of that was. And I think the first writers group that they had was in like July or August of 06. And I must have joined in like September or October. I could be wrong. I think I was in the first one, but I'm not at this point. I can't quite remember.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like back then there was a mix of some of the Onion paper side people that were interested, and also they brought in some like writers from UCB that they liked, like Michael Delaney and like Chris Gethard were in there like in the early stages. Joe Wengert, Chris Kula, who I think you had on here, yeah. Actually maybe Kula was like later, but. But yeah, like a lot of really good improvisers that I didn't know at the time, but like was quickly like amazed by. Plus, you know, some people that would wind up becoming like the Onion News Network core staff.
And so, how long did you take to get to like what you said was like the dry, like very news like stuff?
Not that long. I think it was pretty well understood that what we wanted was like. I mean, we were getting notes from the Onion paper staff. I mean, I think the head writer of the Onion News Network, Carol Kolb, was the editor of the Onion, at least for like I think like 5 years or something like that. Definitely back in like yeah, but before she did the Onion News Network, she was the editor of the Onion. So I think she knew the voice, or she at least knew what when like we were hitting the Onion tone. And then it was kind of everybody else's job to like not crack easy jokes and like not play everything up for like a sort of like capital C comedy style laugh. It's a weird way to like learn like the practice of like comedy writing, because it is so hostile to like jokes and like goofy stuff.
Right.
Like the Onion hates jokes. It's all jokes. The whole thing is like the Onion newspaper is just a bunch of jokes, but like they can't look like jokes, or else like the illusion is completely gone.
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting.
But it took, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months by the time, I mean, our first videos were, our tone didn't really change over the like four or five years that we were doing it. Like 2007. I mean, they look less polished in 2007 than they did in 2011, but like, that's, you know, part of that's technology, but like the voice is basically the same, and it was mostly the same people working on them that mm-hmm. whole time.
What was like your process for like coming up with the headline ideas?
Sit in a coffee shop for like you know, 10 hours. I would
10 hours.
I mean, I don't know. I was lucky because it was like I'm pretty like distractible, and like it was the greatest thing to distract me from like my like coursework, and also the fact that I was having to take like 5 college classes at the time would provide me with a lot of good source material that wasn't necessarily in the news, but also like, you know, I was like taking poli sci classes, and like I remember taking a media class at college, and like stuff like that is directly applicable to working at the Onion News Network. And so, and also like my parents are journalists, so like I've always grown up like consuming a lot of news, and I feel like, yeah, even in like history classes, like if you're learning about like the Ottoman Empire, like it helps to like have a like working understanding of like, you know, where we're bombing Iraq right now. So like, you know, you can like think about things in terms of their historical context. But like, yeah, no, it was just like, I remember, you know, I'd have to do like tons and tons of reading for work, and then like an idea would just kind of like spin off because I'd find something funny in like the reading. And when that didn't happen, I would just like refresh MSNBC.com and CNN.com until like something jumped out at me. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's impossible to to describe how it happened.
Would you ever have cases where you had like a funny headline, but then you couldn't figure out what the video would be?
Yeah, we'd make those one-liners. The crawl, okay, yeah. The crawl at the bottom of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I got way more one-liners than actual like full segments.
Yeah. So for when you're pitching the headline, do you also have to have like the entire like what the video would be and what it looks like?
Yeah, we do like a few sentences of description of where the video would go. That helps kind of. I mean, I think having been on both sides of it when I was contributing and then reading those packets every week from all the contributors, it's like, it's still a headline that has to kind of catch your eye, even though weirdly on a video there is no actual headline.
Right.
And then there has to be copy on the Onion website that goes with the video, which is never the headline, because it's like the headline's always way too long. The headline just kind of describes the idea sort of, but has to be done in headline format. It was a weird way of doing it, but like we kind of got to an equilibrium where like you could kind of tell when an idea had legs based on like those 2 or 3 sentences of description, because like if it was really fertile, you know, there'd be a lot of ideas like in there that you could expand upon. And if there was, and if we didn't believe it, we'd be like, oh, that's a funny headline. It's a one-liner though. Some people would actually just submit one-liners, but they would rarely turn into full segments. I think, yeah.
Is that what you would look for when you're looking at contributors? Like look for like that, like the description that would kind of pop?
Not as much as like a funny headline that was saying something different. The thing that I remember, like every you know 6 months or whatever, we'd have to read 100 packets for contributor applications. And the thing that always struck me was like how similar everything was, and how many times you'd be hearing the same subjects hit over and over again.
I'm sure that's only gotten worse.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Like the weirdest thing is just kind of like working anywhere but the Onion. It's not necessarily a bad thing to have the idea that other people had. I think that's like smiled upon at many places. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because like if you want like a big audience, you kind of want to go where their head is at. And if you're saying what everyone else is thinking, that's not really a bad thing. But like the whole ethos of the Onion was like, you can never repeat yourself. You can never do anything that anyone else did. If anyone has seen this before, it immediately is canceled, which I thought was great. And it like really pushed us to do really awesome stuff. But, was like maybe the bar was set so weirdly high that like it, you know, it makes it harder to like write like regular jokes
right,
you know, afterward, you know.
How did you become the head writer of the video?
Just everyone else got laid off. I don't know.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I was only really head writer for a while, right at the end. People had moved on, and like, you know, I think around 2012 they started losing money a lot. Well, I mean, the videos I don't think ever made them a ton of money, but like the bottom, I'm not a business guy, but like I'm pretty sure that like the bottom fell out of the like internet ad market in like, you know, sometime around the financial crisis, which is weird because that's right when we were like getting started, and the Onion was in an aggressive period of expansion around then. So I'm not sure where all that money was coming from. I believe that the videos were kind of presented as like a loss leader. But the profits just, I guess, never materialized. But I still think it's kind of short-sighted that they laid everybody off, because like I think since then they've struggled to, reestablish their voice in video. Not to say that they're not making great stuff, just that they're not making as like production intensive, like, you know, really high end expensive stuff, which I thought we were nailing for a few years there.
And was this around when they moved out of New York back to Chicago?
Yeah, they were kind of really when they started making cuts to the Onion News Network web series is when we were doing Onion Sports Dome and the Onion News Network TV series, which kind of like it brought the it kind of like took the focus of the staff to this other place, and then they were kind of like, yeah, but we want to keep it going. But then both of the shows kind of like tapered off. Sports Dome went one season. The Onion News Network on IFC went two. And I think they were kind of like, well, I assume somewhere in there someone was like, well, the TV show will just like take over. Yeah. And the successful TV show will like be where all the video goes now. And without a successful TV show, I think they're kind of like, well, our plan was to have a successful TV show. So. But yes, also then they were like, we're going to move to Chicago. That was a huge, dramatic thing. Most of the video people, at least on the video side, it was like, well, you've already laid off a bunch of the staff here. So if we go to Chicago, we don't really know what's waiting for us there. I think it was a much harder decision for the newspaper people because they were like, they basically offered jobs in Chicago to the entire newspaper editorial staff. But I think they were kind of like, we don't want to do that. So there was kind of like a split at that time. Some people went, some didn't. Most of the video people did not go because most of them were gone already. And the ones that remained were just kind of like, I don't know. Kind of seems like maybe this isn't the best idea for us right now. Mm-hmm. But I've gone, you know, I've like worked with The Onion since then. And like we wound up staying for like a year and like doing all this like Onion Digital Studio stuff, which I'm very proud of. And like that, I guess, was when I was technically head writer of Onion Video, although we weren't making Onion News Network videos anymore.
So since you guys were kind of on your own a little bit, because you're away from the rest of the company, was there like a difference in like how you operated after that?
We knew that our time was limited. We knew we had like a year, and then we would basically be cut loose. And we also knew that we couldn't afford to make fake news videos on the level that we had been. And so we were kind of left with this weird mandate that was based on this deal that we'd done with YouTube. This was like when YouTube was just starting to get into like creating their own content that they'd like commissioned. And there's this thing, I guess in 2012, they like went around to like 50 companies and they were like, everybody gets $1 million. Do whatever you want. And so The Onion got $1 million, which in like terms of like TV is nothing. And even in terms of, you know, the web videos we were making were probably like, I don't know, 40 or 50 grand. I mean, there's like, I don't really know I'm not the line producer, so I don't really know how much they cost ultimately, but I know that they were too expensive for us to make 10 hours of them for $1 million, which was basically the assignment. It was like, you make 10 hours of video. And so there were about five of us, and we were just sort of like, well, we're just going to use our process to come up with new ideas. We'll write lists of ideas the same way that we wrote lists of headlines for video, and we'll pick the ones that pass the editorial process the same way we would have picked videos, except the only difference is we don't have to make them fake news anymore.
Mm.
We kind of tried to keep a fake something like mandate. We're like, you know, it's The Onion and we have to like try to stay true to like the idea of The Onion being like a parody centric company. So what can we parody and try to make look authentic enough without, you know, the requirement of like, you know, 10 grand per minute budgets. And so we settled on mostly like reality TV formats.
So all the like Sex House and all that stuff happened after, and it happened like all in that 1 year?
Yes.
Wow. That's incredible.
We wrote all that stuff in like, yeah. And really mostly in like the first 7 or 8 months of that year.
Wow.
And we shot it all too. And like, yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, there were, but we probably wrote like 12 or 16 web series from January to, I don't know, August, September. Not everything that we wrote got made. And then I think eventually, like, they filled out their end of the deal with YouTube by, like, putting up, giving Clickhole the option of, like, putting up a 5-hour, like, video of, like, an American flag waving or something like that.
Oh, really?
Because there are no restrictions. At the time, the business people at The Onion were like, you guys are improvisers, just do some improv. And we were just like, oh, man, that's not what we do here.
Yeah.
But yeah, they basically moved the company to Chicago and left us there because they'd already made this deal. And they were like, all right, we'll get you guys, like, a little tiny office in Brooklyn and you guys can do your thing. And then whenever we shot the videos, they'd fly us out to Chicago.
So you had, like, full, like, creative reign, kind of?
To the extent that no one was really paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I think, to the credit of the business people at The Onion, they're very used to giving the creative side, like, full control. Even because that's kind of, like, the terms that were, I guess, the terms that have always been dictated from The Onion paper, which built the company. It was like, look, listen to us. This is how we did it. Like, you guys sell ads, which, you know, it can make for some, like, contentious meetings. But, like, mm-hmm. I think they really did try their best to, like, let us have free reign, because it was obviously easier for them to, anyway.
Wow.
To just, like, not worry about it.
One of my favorite web series is Sex House.
Oh, yes.
Which came from that. How did the, what was the, like, genesis of that idea?
I think that was actually Carol's idea, Carol Kolb. We did, like, a couple weeks of development before we all busted out and, like, they closed the office on us. Actually, we wrote all of, I shouldn't say that. They didn't close the office until, like, March or April of that year, I believe. I mean, these dates run together at this point. But, like, yeah, they were shutting things down for a while and, like, we had a few development weeks with Dan Merck and Carol Kolb. Maybe just one, I don't know. But anyway, I think it was Carol's idea. It was a very, very sort of like clean idea and everybody immediately got it. And then I think Carol was working on another project and we were just like, can we run with this? And she was like, yeah. So we wrote it. And that was kind of the beginning of us really figuring out that what we really wanted to do with everything was like take it down a really weird, like sort of dark plot route, mm-hmm. Or like just kind of like flesh it out to a degree that, I mean, like even in 2012, like reality parody was old already. Like we'd all seen like the like Chappelle Show Real World parody. Like everyone's seen the like parody of the reality TV show. So we were like, what can we do to like put our own spin on it and like make it worth watching? And we were like, well, why don't we make it a serialized narrative that actually like takes twists and turns that like, you know, people don't necessarily anticipate or really know that they want to see. A lot of people have a hard time watching Sex House and a lot of the stuff that we did that year, because it's very weird.
I do remember thinking it was odd, like The Onion's making a parody of The Real World. That's so strange in 2012 mm-hmm. to see that. And then I watched the first episode and I was like a couple minutes in, I was like, what? This is fine, I guess. But, and then of course it goes like to this crazy place.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. You say it's like such a clean, you said it was like a clean idea. Because to me, I have struggled so much to explain what Sex House is to people.
Well, the way that Carol pitched it was just like, it's like one of those shows where they just put a bunch of like hot people in a house, but they don't want to have sex. And they're like, what do they do? and we, at the time, we were all like having this like, you know, annoying experience of like, this company is like shutting itself down on us. And like, we got all mad at like the like business considerations of the company and how the, you know, how we felt the interests were being driven by like money concerns. And like in our sort of like petulance, we're just like, let's make this about how like the production, like the producers of a show like this are the actual like villains and right. not like the contestants who generally in the like parody version of this are the ones that like people gravitate toward making fun of. Cause it's like so easy to like make fun of people that would want to be on a reality mm-hmm. TV show. But, like, yeah, our take on it was more like, these are just some people that want to be on TV. Like, it's not their fault. Like everyone is conditioned to want to be on TV. Like, right. You shouldn't really shit on those people. Like, right. what did they do?
When you're making these, like, longer narrative stuff, Are you like making, is it like fully set when you finish writing it, or as like you start filming it, do things change?
I don't think we had that. We were not in the habit of doing a lot of improv on the Onion News Network. And again, like, we used the process that we used on all of these for writing them was the exact process that we used on the Onion News Network, which is basically just like write 10 times as much stuff as you actually need. And we didn't really have a ton of, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this. Like, the Onion News Network required like a lot of like 70-year-olds, like six people in their 40s to 70s, because like, you know, to make a convincing news broadcast, you need like, you know, stately looking individuals and like, you know, people that bystanders on the street that aren't just like clearly like 22-year-old like comedy students. And so we didn't like really have access to like the best acting pool for our like single roles, because like in order to make it like look convincing, like you could not just use like a cast of five people that were playing every role, because then immediately it looks like a sketch show. You need different people every time. And so like we can't really afford like super good actors every time, so we kind of have to give them the line verbatim and just drill it into them, like, and do like 30 takes until they like inflect it the way that we want to. Mm-hmm. Which is like, when you wind up working with real actors, a very annoying thing for them, because they're like,
right,
hello, I'm actually like an interesting and creative person here, and I understand this. I have a very high intelligence for this stuff. Just let me do my job. And it's like, all right, yeah, sorry. I come from this place where like the only people that we get into these videos are like weird like heiresses that like haven't had any human contact for 40 years that like want to be in a web video. And so like for Sex House, we were casting in Chicago, a city that none of us really knew. And we were like, you know, we need some good actors, but we didn't really have the time or the budget to go after like people who we wouldn't necessarily trust with a bunch of comedic decisions. That said, you know, they impressed us. I thought the cast was great across the board. And like, I'm sure there were plenty of like, you know, like ad libbed things in there that were great. But at the time it was like, we have 5 days to shoot this, so we don't really have time to like let the camera roll. And also, like, we don't know who's editing it. We no longer have like the production crew that we had at the Onion News Network, where we could trust like Sasha to like pull out the hilarious bit and like find a way to put it into the cut. It's just like, we have no idea what the next stage of this is, so we really have to kind of like keep a tight lock on it as much as possible.
So the Sex House was all shot in 5 days?
I think so, maybe even four.
Wow.
But like, yeah, it was like Sex House and Lake Dredge Appraisal, which was another series we did at that time, were shot in the same week. We did them both in 1 week.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have...
But really, it's not that crazy, because, like, now... Yeah. I mean, like, at the time, it felt super intense. But, like, they shoot, like, half-hour TV shows in, like, a week sometimes. And,
well,
like,
but they've got bigger budgets and bigger sets and whatnot.
That's true. Yeah, it felt... I certainly felt like we were accomplishing a lot. And the fact that it... turned out as well as it did, it's like I think a testament to everyone that worked on it, not just our writing and the acting, but like the crew in Chicago was very excited to work with us. We got really lucky with like the crew that we wound up getting, and that's, there's no one to credit for that except the Onion business staff, because they helped hook us up with that crew, so I can't like shit on them.
What was the process for you guys in deciding what was like worthy of doing like a series on?
I think it was just, I mean, that kind of is like wrapped up in the same question of like, what is the criteria for like selecting any joke? I think it's basically just the brains of everyone involved in like reading the list of ideas being like, this is the one I like. No, that's a bad idea. This is the one I like. Oh, me too. It's just a consensus thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because like Onion Talks, that's like a parody of TED Talks.
Yeah.
That's a very easy sell, I'd say.
Yeah.
But then, like, Lake Dredge Appraisal, which is a parody of, like, Antique Roadshow, is maybe a slightly harder sell, I would say.
Yeah. I don't know how we got Lake Dredge through, but it's just, like, one of those things where, like, people responded to it. And
it's enough, really funny. Yeah,
enough. Yeah. I appreciate that. That's, like, one of my favorite ideas I've ever had. Like, I remember the editor of the Onion paper at the time. There were a couple meetings where like the paper staff was also pitching web series for some reason, and I'd written the idea for Lake Dredge for that meeting, and Joe Randazzo liked it, and I was like, oh, cool. Like, I actually, like, impressed the editor of the paper. So, like, I like, held on to it and, like, brought it in front of the, like, easier crowd, I guess. I mean, not easier, but, like, my friends who I thought would like it, and they did. And I don't know. It's just one of those weird things. We had other weird ideas that got through. But, yeah, Lake Dredge turned out well.
What made you, like, think of that? Were you, like, a big antique road show?
Actually, no, not at all. I just kind of, I don't know. It just seemed like an easy, like, swap.
Yeah, yeah. You know? It's interesting.
But the character is really what make that work, you know? Like, and, like, I think that played to our strengths in finding, like, interesting older actors.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, everybody in that show is just, excepting the host who's, like, a star of Chicago Fire, I think. Or, I mean, I don't really watch Chicago Fire, but I know he's on Chicago Fire, and he was back then, too. I think it's, like, a long-running show. I'm exposing my ignorance here, but, like, he's, like, a well-known actor in Chicago, I guess, and he's great.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, and, like, and everybody else. I mean, I'm sure I'm embarrassing myself. I'm sure they're all, like, you know, like, like, successful, like, actors in Chicago, which is a great city for theater, and, like, you know, but we just knew them as, like, interesting-looking older dudes that had good auditions, and mm-hmm. so we're like, okay, cool, we know how to do this.
So you mentioned that you had stuff that you pitched that you never filmed. Was there anything, like, what was something, like, an interesting idea of one of those?
I really have to, it's been so long. Hold on. I'm like resisting the urge to pull my phone out. There was one series that we were going to do that was just, like, people being fired, like, videos of people being fired, but that was a vindictive one that I think that was, like, right at the end when we were all angry about being fired. What else? Well, like, there's this one that Kleinman always wanted to do that we've been kicking around for literally 5 years called Who Killed Ventostro, which is kind of like a parody of those, like, History Channel shows where they, like, kind of, like, follow a weird, like, thread of some, like, suspicious, like, were aliens, like, like, real or whatever. Like, at the time, that felt fresh to us. I think now there's, like, Action Bronson watching, like, Ancient Aliens, like, on Viceland. I feel like people have, like, kind of hit that area now. But, like, at the time, it felt like there were all these weird shows out that would, like, pose a question and then just, like, follow it to, like, ridiculous extremes. And so the thing was going to be, like, this entire, like, long serialized show is based on the premise of, like, maybe there was a man called Ventostro and maybe he got killed. And if he was killed, like, what else might have happened? And, like, who did it? Like, but, you know, with no real facts involved.
Yeah.
But it always got, I think, like, we'd always get tripped up somehow, maybe on the no fact thing, you know, just making up.
Right.
It's kind of hard to get people invested in that idea.
Yeah.
But Kleinman will tell you, man, I mean, he has plans for that. He's like, at this point, it's probably like a 200-page pitch document that he's been working on for like almost a decade.
Wait, is he, I mean.
No, not really. Okay. I mean, he's just been like, he still loves that idea. He's going to make it one day.
Now there's, they're finally catching up to, like, all the serial parodies.
Yeah.
Or Making a Murder parodies, I guess both, with American Vandal, which is really funny.
Yeah, I liked American Vandal.
And then they got that. There's a John Lithgow show too, I think, or something.
Oh, there is.
I think it's called, like, Trial.
He's got a solo show on Broadway right now.
I saw it.
You did?
Because I have a friend who's in town with me right now, and he wanted to go see a Broadway show, and those were the cheapest tickets we could find. They're $25.
Hey, see, all right, see.
And it's a really weird show. He tells just like a fairy tale stories, but he, like, acts them out.
Is he an interesting man?
Well,
but is it hard to tell? Does he conceal it in character?
He conceals it in character. It's not a typical one man show.
Huh.
So
it's not really about him. It's about, like, stories he likes.
He tells, like, two stories, one in each act. And then, spoiler alert for John Lithgow's stories by heart. But, he like, kind of says, like, this is a reflection of me, like he says.
Right.
Like, these stories mean a lot to me. But then he doesn't really explain the first one at all. And the second one, just a story about his parents were kind of ill and he read the story to them.
I was worried you were going to say, like, they were all just stories about, like, him being beaten by his parents or something.
Oh, no, that'd be a real bummer.
I'm glad John Lithgow was not abused.
No, and he's a nice man.
Yeah, he seems nice.
Go see Stories by Heart.
Do you think it was, like, a corrupt deal that got him on Broadway? Maybe I'm misjudging the market, but I don't feel like there's a giant demand for John Lithgow solo shows.
Well, it's a weird thing about Broadway, I feel like, is if they're very generous to people who are like stars,
right? Who have like put their time in.
Yeah,
and he's definitely a man who paid his dues.
He's done a lot of Broadway shows.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's just like payback. I mean, I saw it last Wednesday at 2 p.m. and there was no one there.
Oh man, but was he still giving it his all?
Oh, of course, a consummate professional.
I think that's, you know, that's what it's all about.
There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, back to the back to the onion. After like a year of doing those shows, they like fired. They finished off the.
Yeah, well, I shouldn't say fired. I mean, like we there was an understanding that it was going to be over after a year, and we all had made our peace with that. But we were still angry and wished that they'd do more because we were having such a good time.
Right.
It. Yeah.
And also, like, I feel like that period of videos were like really critically acclaimed by people.
I was very happy that they got seen. I think part of what we wanted to do was to game the YouTube algorithm by calling something sex house.
And it worked.
And it fucking worked, man. And like it took other people. I mean, I feel like everybody knew that. Like anyone who's ever searched for anything on YouTube could see that something with like a suggestive thumbnail has like 75 million views. So part of it is because of that. And so I'm fooling myself if I think it's because it was that good. But I think it got people in the door. And then if they stayed, they realized it was actually interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Sex House was like a big deal when it came out. Like people were writing about it all everywhere.
I'm glad. Yeah. I mean, like I was very happy that like it got seen. Like people really, I still meet people who have seen it, like that don't know me, which is great. Like,
yeah.
I mean, and it's nothing. I mean, it's the combination of being able to stand on the platform of The Onion. And it wouldn't, I think part of it is like we kind of, and I felt bad about this at the time. Because we did kind of just like hijack The Onion's brand to do this like kind of off-brand stuff, this like sort of like B-label stuff. But I think that we kind of had their blessing because we had to, because like the business staff had already made this deal where they were like, yeah, 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 sure, 10 hours video, we'll do it. And the paper staff was just like, whatever, as long as it's not on the homepage, like we don't care. Like, because it would fuck with the illusion of it being a newspaper if there was like a video that was like, hey, look at our new reality TV show. Yeah. But I think they did actually like put some ads, though. As ads, not as like content, though. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a good way of promoting it. Mm-hmm.
As someone who did a lot of online comedy, digital comedy, what do you think the future is now?
You've clearly already talked to Kleinman about this.
Yeah, Kleinman had a big answer.
Well, I mean, I know he's very pessimistic about it, and I won't pretend that I'm not too...
I think it's only gotten worse since I had him on the show because like Crack laid off all those people.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm basically in line with Kleinman's views on how the internet's been kind of like homogenized in the social media era. When I was like 12, I was making websites. I like taught myself HTML. Hey guys, I know HTML. I believe I'm bragging about knowing HTML. It seemed so open and it seemed so limitless and it felt so bizarre and like anything. You never knew what was going to happen online. And like, that's still true. Like I was saying, like they're great. I don't think the internet has ever been funnier, but at the same time, there's less originality, there's less variety, there's less the capacity, like you get surprised every day by something funny online, but it always surprises you in the same sort of way. And I think that like, I think there used to be like, do you remember the feeling of like coming upon, have you ever been to like timecube.com?
That sounds familiar.
It's like an older, it was an older thing that kind of like, I guess you could say like went viral before people started saying that, but like it was a weird, just an insane man put up this website with a ton of detail, all about his like wild conspiracy theories about like the like, you know, sort of like seven dimensional plane. Mm. I don't really remember what the actual like theories were, but it was executed with total, like you just knew that this was made by a crazy man.
Yeah.
And he did it all himself and he made it all by hand and he made the graphics and he like coded it. And like when a crazy person codes something, you know, it looks like a sign that was like drawn by a crazy person, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
When a crazy person goes on Facebook, it's just like all caps ranting in Facebook, like post style.
Right.
But like back in the day, like you really had to like put a ton of work in just to get something online. And the fact that there weren't as many what you see is what you get templates for it meant that like the creativity was necessarily like bewilderingly like, you know, like diverse. And that was part of what I think originally made the internet seem so cool. And I think it's great that it's easier to use, but I think in the ease of use, we've sacrificed. This wasn't your question at all. You're asking about internet comedy, but like, but I do think that has an effect on comedy. And I think the fact that you can't make money online unless you play by Facebook's rules, has been terrible, not just for newspapers, but also for comedy outlets.
Right. And well, YouTube just did they just did a new thing, right? With like, you have to have like 100 hours to make money on commercials now, I think.
Really? I didn't know that.
That's maybe secondhand information. So I'm not sure if that's 100% right, but I think I read something like that.
Yeah, I guess I have a sort of like annoyingly old school, like maybe even like Gen X, like view on the fact that I think it sucks when a single company controls like an entire art form. And I think that like Vine is a great example. Like, you know, Vine was a really cool thing. That was like a really great Web 2.0 thing. I know no one even says Web 2.0 anymore at this point, but like at the time it was like, oh, Vine, like social video sharing. It's like the advancement of YouTube for people with even shorter attention spans, and like people made it this cool thing. I was never on Vine, but like I thought it was great. It was, you can only really describe it, I think, as like a unique art form, because it is not like TV or even web video. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, it's kind of like, I guess, Snapchat, kind of like Instagram stories, maybe. But like the limitations really defined it. Nevertheless, it wasn't that appealing to me, because having watched every website up until that point have its like heyday and then go down, I kind of was like, well, what happens when like Vine goes down? And like it did. And like, I hate that it did, but like, it always happens with these websites. And the only exceptions so far have been YouTube and Facebook. And YouTube built that on the backs of the recording industry and like the piracy industry. And like, Facebook did that by like stealing all the money from the media. But yeah. I mean, I think that's my working understanding of it. But like, having grown up, you know, I'm loath to use the term digital native. But like,
I think that's like the technical term.
Yeah, but like, you know, I was in AOL People Connection when I was 9 or 10 years old, and like, you just watch it grow, and it's easy when you have nothing else to do but sit at home on the computer as like a young teenager and like see that change. And like, it has, and like, the internet matured to a point where the original generation of people that were raised on it knew how to like learn how to work it and then optimize it and like monetize it. And once the entire economy moved online, I think it kind of crushed some of the more like interesting creative parts of it. Not that you can't go and make your own website now, but the problem is an entire generation has been raised not knowing to type in a URL anymore. And so it's like websites are basically over. Like, yeah. When The Onion went to Chicago, the paper staff started this website called Thing X, and it was all really content. It was all hilarious. But they were starting a new website in an era when like starting a new website was no longer really a business plan so much as one of several things you could do. And like, it's just, I don't know, other than like, I can't think of that many like new websites that like have been launched in the past 5 years that like I actually go to, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I don't think so either.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know. So it's weird for online comedy. I was telling someone the other day that I really do believe that the Onion News Network was like the best short form web video series ever on the internet. And it probably will be. I mean, I guess you have to kind of put a distinction between like the Netflix, Amazon, Hulu era of the internet and the like, you know, older, you know, 5-10 years ago internet. I'm sure someone will eventually come up with the like right like name for that.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I just don't see no one's like putting money into web video like that.
Yeah.
Except maybe like Funny or Die. But they still, I think part of that is like, and I can't speak to it because I haven't worked there, but like, I know that Kleinman did, and like, I have friends that work there, and like, I do think there is a lot of like trying to make sure that what they make plays well with the algorithm. And like, that's a weird consideration. There's always some version of that it was SEO before that, and before that it was like, I don't know, like what was before that? I don't really remember what was before SEO. That was the first time I really had to care about it. But it's like you had to make something that was related to something popular because that's how people would find your thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do now is just a version of that.
Even Flick or Die, I mean, they also had like pretty major. They laid off the New York staff.
Yeah, that was a bummer.
Yeah, and then in LA, I mean, they make way less videos than they used to, which is especially in their heyday a couple of years ago. They're making like new videos from interesting people like every day.
Yeah, it was great. Everybody would hang out. I mean, you can kind of, again, it's like I don't want to like make excuses for like business people like shutting down cool stuff, but like visiting the Funny or Die offices in New York was so much fun every time that I was like, this can't possibly last forever. I was like, this is too fun. Like, everyone's having way too much fun here. They can't possibly be making enough money.
All right, let's switch gears to, you did a couple Adult Swim infomercials.
Yeah, those were mostly with the same dudes that we did, that worked on like Sex House together and all that. We were doing stuff under the name Wild Aggressive Dog. And still do to a certain degree, although, you know, it's times are, you know, the dog times are lean. but yeah, basically coming right off of that year in 2012, when we did all those web series, we had, we were kind of all on the same creative wavelength and we really liked working together and we were all frustrated that we couldn't continue to get paid to work together. So we were just like, why don't we just like pitch some ideas? We'd been contacted by, Becca Kinski, who's now a producer at Funny or Die, actually, in L.A., and she was working at a company called Abominable at the time, and they did a bunch of, like, Adult Swim shows, and they had sort of found some of the writings of Chris Sartinsky, who was part of that crew, and so they got in touch with him, and somehow through that conversation, they were like, do you want to pitch us an infomercial? And so I think we sent him a bunch of ideas, and the first one we did was called For Profit Online University, which was kind of like an outgrowth. I think I pitched it. Our rules were basically like, if it's your idea, you become the head writer when you make it, because we wanted to be egalitarian about it. And also, like, I didn't want to assume that just because I was the head writer on all the Onion Digital Studios stuff, or most of it, that meant I was always going to be the boss of these guys, especially when we weren't like in a company arrangement where I'd been kind of installed in that position. But it happened that this was my idea because it was an outgrowth of a character that I'd been performing at like shows here in New York and like basically just like a huckster college owner slash professor. And, you know, it kind of dovetailed with all of our hatred of, well, not hatred, but like, you know, it dovetailed with a lot of the sort of skepticism and the themes we were exploring with like a lot of that Onion Digital Studio stuff. And so we like banged out a couple drafts of it and then flew out to LA and made it.
It definitely feels like an outgrowth of like the stuff you were doing before.
Yeah.
Was that, were you guys just like still in that like satirical mindset, or is that just like what you guys like to do?
Well, I think that's kind of how we got to know each other, because none of us knew each other before The Onion. We were only put together as writers on the Onion News Network, and we just kind of, through that, having worked together for years on that, like, learned that we like liked what each of us brought to the table, and we were basically like each other's favorite writers, or at least among the ones that were still around, because other people would leave and like get good jobs and stuff, and like so we only knew each other through satire. And so that's why the, you know, the fake like reality shows had a satirical bent, and it's why the infomercials did too. Cause it's just like, we're not used to writing any other way together. Even though some of the other guys like Jeff Haggerty was like a very proficient, like character performer and like sketch writer for his own sketch group, like outside of the Onion. Elephant Larry, as they were and are called.
What was like different about doing the infomercials versus like the Onion Digital stuff?
We worked with unionized professionals in Los Angeles, which is like a new experience for me, at least. Which meant that we had to do it on their schedule, and we didn't have the luxury of like infinite rewrites and like infinite tweaks. The only part where I did have that was with the animator that we were working with, who did a bunch of the animated stuff for Profit Online University, who was actually based out of Great Britain. And I don't know exactly how they found him at Abominable. I think Becca found him. But I was able to, like, email with him constantly for, like, weeks and weeks and weeks until we had the animation perfect. But, yeah, no, it's mainly just, like, professionals and, like, not being able to waste everyone's time as much as we had before. And, the expense of it. Like, I think the budget was higher on that thing than, like, you know, probably at least half of the, like, series we did for Onion Digital Studios combined, just because we weren't working with unions before.
Mm. So when you're doing, like, an infomercial, I guess, what are, like, the hallmarks of a good, like, fake infomercial?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, at this point, I feel like you need to subvert the format immediately because people are, like, so expecting it now. But then also people expect it to be subverted because, like, Too Many Cooks came out and, like, you know, like, even there's a great new one that John Harris and Dan Guterman wrote that's, like, about this, like, coyote suit that you wear that, like, takes some pretty, like, unexpected turns. Mm. But, like, I think also now you know that it's going to be subverted, so you need to also, like, subvert the subversion of it. And then it becomes this crazy hall of mirrors where it's, like, I don't know. That's always where my mind goes with this stuff. At least when I think back to, like, how we were approaching it, it's, like, okay, how did we not make this the thing that everyone thinks they're going to see? Like, we did this one, Smart Pipe, and, like, it starts out being a pretty straight-ahead, like, you know, like, send-up of, like, a tech company and their, like, bullshit ideas. And then it veers off into this side plot about pedophilia and, like, the company being in, like, legal hot water because they're, like, showing pictures of kids' anuses as, like, part of their, like, tech scheme. Which, of course, like, no, I don't know. Like, I think it fascinated us to, like, get into how, like, every startup, like, encounters this point. It happened with, like, Uber. It's definitely happening with Facebook now, where, like, there's this horrible externality that they had never anticipated needing to worry about, and now they're responsible for it. And it's like, oh, okay, shit, this always happens. Mm-hmm. Like, so what would that be with, like, a Internet of Things thing? But yeah, hallmarks of a good infomercial. I mean, like, I'm really a stickler for getting the details of the tone right. Like, and this is also something that The Onion inculcated in me. It's like, I have a very hard time suspending disbelief for shit that doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like, because that's, anyone should be able to counterfeit it correctly. Like, we live in an era of, like, screenshots and, like, you know, Shazam and, like, stuff. Like, you should be able to figure out exactly what is in, you know, the frame that you're trying to, like, make a counterfeit version of. So, like, it bums me out when that's not thought about. Or, like, when like, the budget doesn't match the concept and no one thought to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, like, you could definitely, with infinite money, you could, like, make a really good Game of Thrones parody. But, like, if you have, like, 25 grand, you don't want to be like, okay, we need a castle and a giant CGI dragon. Because then it's just, like, both of those will look wrong because you don't have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I think, like, a lot of it has to do with, like, matching up the, like, scale of the vision to, like, the project, which I think gets not thought about enough, even though people definitely think about it. But, like, I think it's really easy to see when, like, that goes wrong. And I think it's something that people are like, no one will notice, but, like, people do.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not enough. Maybe I overthink it.
I think people notice it.
Yeah.
Were you when you're doing the For Profit University, were you watching, like, a lot of For Profit University?
Yeah, well, luckily those are very easy to find, and they're all very low budget, which is, like, why I think that worked for us, because it was like, dude, a DeVry commercial is just, like, a floodlight and, like, some people sitting in, like, a soundstage,
right.
And we can afford that, because, like, that's probably the budget they had, too. Or, like, you know, it's a green screen with, like, a, like, stock footage behind
mm-hmm.
it.
The college commercials in general are so weird. Like, if you watch, like, any college football, they, like, show up now. It's, like, at, like, University of Alabama.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, why would they even need to advertise that?
I don't know. And then there was one that was just, like, SEC. Like, just, like, that conference with just all the different colleges.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I get SEC, but, like, I remember at college, like, you had to, like, sell ads for your publication. Like, when I was doing the Humor magazine, I'd have to, like, go around to businesses and, like uptown and, like, just be like, yo, come on. Give us $400 and, like, you know, we'll put like the logo of your bodega in this magazine. And like all of the, you know, some of them were known as places that would do that. And I just, after a while I was like, they've got to be just like getting kickbacks from the school. Like they must know that this is just like pushing paper around and like kind of like helping people like meet their budget, like marks or whatever. But maybe it's also just because they know that, you know, they're going to get called by the catering company. And so, like, part of the, like, wink-wink agreement is, right. like, you also have to, like, kick some money to, like, the college publications when they come asking you for it. But, like, this is in 2007 when, like, there's no print public. No one, even then, people were like, I don't really want to put a print ad out. Especially not in a magazine that, like, 20 people are going to read. And, like, these fucking, these, like, businesses have no idea, like, what they're giving money to. They're just like, all right, yes, we have it in our budget. We set aside this money for the, like, first person who asks us, basically.
I was one of the editors-in-chief of our college.
Oh, sweet.
And we eventually had to, like, just get money from the school because we couldn't meet our budget. Yeah. Except for there was a Mexican restaurant, and they would give us, they paid for ads for, like, the entire year because it was, like, a monthly thing. And then they would give us half money, and half they'd give us as a gift certificate.
That rules. To have and your so party would, at the Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, every semester we'd have a big Mexican dinner, which was great.
Was it good?
It was all right. I mean, it wasn't fantastic Mexican food.
Where'd you go to college?
In Connecticut.
Oh, cool. So it's terrible Mexican food. Yeah, in Connecticut. Yeah. You're very lucky to get some good Mexican food up there.
Yeah, Ixtapa Grill.
Oh, all right.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
And you recently were working on Tarantula.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Actually related to the Onion Digital Studios videos, I did, one of the ones that I directed was called Porking Across America, which was like, we used the Today Now, the Onion morning show character, and put him in a Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives type situation where he like is an asshole to his family and his life kind of falls apart and he eventually winds up turning into a pig. Mm-hmm. It was very, you know, like a fable, like a Grimm's fairy tale or something, but like, but we loved the guy who played Jim Haggerty on Today Now, and he was, like, our favorite. He was, like, you know, there are a few recurring characters in the Onion world, and, like, he was probably the most, he probably got it the most out of all the actors that we worked with.
Oh, interesting.
And he was just, like, he had great comedic instincts, and he's hilarious, and, like, and so we were, like, let's write a show for him, and I was lucky enough to get to direct it. And Carson Mell, who created Tarantula, saw Porking Across America and sent me an email after he saw it, and he was like, hey man, you don't know me, but like I saw your name in the credits of Porking Across America, like I really liked it. And I was like, no, I do know you, I've like seen your short film that you made for McSweeney's in like 2008. I was obsessed with it. It's called Chanto. It's about like this like country music guy who like buys a monkey and eventually has to let him go. And it was just like the best short animated like film I'd ever seen, and it was hilarious, and it was like soulful, and it was just like, whoa man, like this is it, really. Even the first time I watched it, I was like, I've never seen anything like this, and this guy's a genius. And so I was very stoked to get a letter from him, because I was like, oh shit, I know you, I'm like a fan of yours. And so eventually like we became friends, and then like when I started going out to LA, we'd like meet up and like eat tacos and stuff. And then like after a while he was like, hey, I'm like gonna have this show, like do you want to work on it? And I was like, of course.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it was like, it was probably the best job I've ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was such a great experience working on that show. It just came out and it kind of didn't get an ad campaign. So I'm right. like wondering, I'm not sure exactly what's happening with it. I assume that means it will be canceled. Cause like what show comes out to like no response and like doesn't get canceled. But it was a weird situation because like, TBS was starting this animated block, and I believe the plan was to have our show follow or precede the Louis C.K. cop show that had to get canceled. And so I think TBS was kind of left with this other show, and they were like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
But I can't presume to know what they're thinking. So, hey, fingers crossed. You never know. Yeah. I thought it was so good. I encourage anyone who is hearing this to please seek it out. It is my favorite thing. It's so good. Carson's a genius. It was such an honor to work for him. It's got like, it's the only thing that I've ever worked on that like has heart. Like none of that, not that that's like a particularly like great endorsement of it, 'cause like who the fuck knows if I have any heart, but like But no, it was cool to work in a not strictly satirical or not strictly joke
right
format. And he kind of helped, you know, he helped shepherd me along in that direction. And it's like, it was like really nice to be able to like work on a vision that like you really believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's on the TBS app.
On the TBS app.
Yeah.
On TBS.com. You need to steal a cable login to do that. But yeah, the first two are on YouTube, but like it gets better and better. You know, the next season will be even better when we get renewed. I'm in denial, but whatever. I still hope it will get renewed, even if there's no logical reason for it to be.
They do the TBS. They're trying to do that. They're trying to binge things more.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe it's a good sign.
And you know, once you're on the proprietary binge platform, like you don't really know how many people are looking at the thing. Like it's who knows what the ratings are on the TBS app?
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe there's a chance.
And now you're working on our cartoon president.
I am, yes.
How did that gig come about?
I worked with the showrunner, RJ Fried, on the Jack and Triumph show, which is the Triumph, the Insult Comic Dog, Jack McBrayer program on Adult Swim. And he was also a contributor to Onion Sports Dome, the underseen gem. There's a theme here of everything I work on being canceled quickly. But Onion Sports Dome is like also, I think, a really great, like, underseen show, that grew directly out of the Onion News Network.
And that was like a weird thing, cause like they had like that Norm Macdonald show, right?
Yes. Yeah. And those came out at the same time and they didn't really, I don't know. They weren't, I mean, they're very different shows.
Yeah.
I love Norm Macdonald. I was very sad when he was talking some shit on Onion Sports Dome and I was like, no, Norm, no, but whatever. I get it. Sports Dome was definitely very hostile to sports, even though it was a show about sports. Like, and we were sports fans. It just wasn't like, you know, it was satirical. It was like pretty hard edged and not just kind of like idol worship.
Right.
But anyway, I'm not promoting Onion Sports Dome here. I'm was I still making excuses for it? No, I'm talking about how I know RJ. Yeah. So like RJ worked on Sports Dome. He worked on Jack and Triumph. Great, great joke writer, hilarious dude. I put in a packet. He claims to have read them blind, and I was lucky enough to get picked. You know, I believe in his integrity. I'd like to think that I, you know, my packet rose to the top.
What was that? What was like the packet like for that?
Write a bunch of plot lines involving Donald Trump.
Yeah,
and write a bunch of jokes. I'm trying to remember if it was like. They weren't like monologue style jokes, but they were kind of like some. There's like a short script, bunch of plot ideas, and I think some jokes. I forget what kind of jokes. Trump jokes.
So, how do you approach writing about Trump?
It's hard to be savage enough, in my opinion. Also because there's so much Trump content, so it's tricky. It's also tricky. The tricky thing about a show like this is that it's produced by Stephen Colbert, the like, great all-time genius of comedy, who has a show on CBS, but our show comes out on Showtime, which has vastly different standards. However, a lot of the staff is used to working on a CBS show, and the executives from CBS and Showtime are talking to each other. And like, so there's a lot of... I think there are a lot of different thresholds for like how grimy we can go with like truly, you know, as the internet would say, eviscerating Donald Trump, which I'm not even sure is possible in comedy form because the man is kind of like a self-parodying individual and like that's part of what makes him popular. And so in some ways, like comedy is impotent and we're all like fooling ourselves now. but I definitely wanted to try because like I've been working in animation the last couple of years, it's like, oh, cool. This, like, again, it's like a nice nexus of, like, things that I'm already interested in.
Mm-hmm. So it's a cartoon. How do you do current events for, like, a cartoon? Or do you just shy away from it completely?
Well, on The Late Show, they've been doing these animated Donald Trump bits for a while now. Oh, okay. And so that's kind of where the show came from. And they've basically developed a new technology. Adobe makes a program now that's, like, almost like building puppets rather than animating. Like, you can kind of map animated features to like motion capture points. And so they were able, they're able to actually like do live interviews now with animated figures on The Late Show. And so I think the idea for this show kind of came out of that, like what, how topical could we get? And so basically there are elements of the show that will be swapped in fresh every week in a topical style, which I'm excited for, because I feel like that's the new thing. There, it is. The, yeah. At first, it felt like kind of like we're trying to do South Park and like just like write a show in a week. But as time goes has gone on, it's like, okay, no. We're like adding more layers on top of that every week and like changing stuff that's like changing in real life. And kind of, I think we're going to go down to the line as much as possible, or down to the wire, I guess, and like, and really try to have it be as up to date as any animated show has ever been.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's cool. It should be really fun. It's coming out in a couple weeks, so we're like getting close.
Yeah.
Cool. They're starting to come together.
What would you like to be doing like next?
Oh man, I don't know. I'm happy. Yeah, everything is great. I'm just I like working, man. You know how it is.
Yeah.
Like get some jobs. Jobs are good. Trying to stay working, stay active. You know, build the structure one brick at a time. There.
Okay, so we're gonna wrap up with the classic segment.
Yes.
This is with you giving your thoughts on something I wrote.
Yes.
This is a sketch idea.
All right.
This is a very simple one. It would be a trailer parody. It'd be like a Freaky Friday, but they're twins. And they're like exactly alike, so it's kind of like, I guess, an anti-comedy thing. So they're like very tight friends, and it's a very manageable situation.
But they realize that they've been switched.
But they realize been switched,
and nobody else really notices.
Yeah, and then they're like, I guess this is going to be kind of an annoying day. It's like kind of like this is just an mild inconvenience.
I think you should take it to the extreme and have them like really freak out about it, and have everyone else like worried about that.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, like I don't know, like. Yeah, man, like go fully extreme and have them like flipping their shit and being like, don't fucking wear my clothes. You're wearing my clothes. You have my hairstyle. I don't know. Like I'm scared of ideas where it's like, and then they were bored, you know?
Right. That's true. That is very, yeah.
Yeah. You know how it is. You don't want to, I mean, that was, yeah. Don't write something where the joke is that everyone is bored. Make them freak out about it,
right? And so
then they can act goofy, and then you can let the improviser that you hire go totally wild, and then they'll come up with a better line, and then you can just like shape the whole piece around what they came up with.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah,
I like that. Sweet. I mean, that's the that's my knee jerk response.
No, that makes sense, because it is too like anti comedy, just like.
Hey, look, I love anti-comedy. Yeah. But you can also make anti-comedy, like, obscenely anti-comedy. And,
right.
Like, just make it annoyingly absurd.
Yeah. Just fun. Anything you want to plug? Our Cartoon President?
Cartoon President's coming out February 11th. And watch Tarantula on TBS.com.
All right.
Or TBS. Because I imagine sometimes they run it in the middle of the night or something.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me, man. This was fun.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of On Comedy Writing. I want to thank Nick Doss for supplying the sweet tunes, Zachary Glassman for giving us the awesome logo, and Boardwalk Audio for hosting us. Please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes, and like and follow On Comedy Writing on Facebook and Twitter. See you next week!
And a Boardwalk Audio podcast. For more information and shows, visit BoardwalkAudio.com. Don't forget to rate and subscribe now.